Okay, subject for today is what we call in Hebrew, tzadik v'ralo, rasha v'tovlo, which is, to put it in English, why do bad things happen to good people, and why do good things happen to bad people? As you probably know, there is an entire book of Tanakh written addressing this problem, which is called the Book of Eov, Job, right, and about a person who is basically an innocent guy, apparently, and he suffers horrifically. The question arises in the following way, which is that being that God can do anything and wants to do good and nothing can stop him and he knows everything, therefore, how could it possibly be that someone is suffering when he doesn't deserve it? How could it possibly be that someone who doesn't deserve success is successful? So Milton Steinberg, American philosopher, pointed out that it is true, he says, that a believer in God must explain suffering. He says, however, he says, someone who doesn't believe has to explain absolutely everything else. And he says he's a lot more comfortable explaining suffering than everything else. So that's what we're going to try to do today. A few words of introduction, if you see on the outline. I didn't make enough. Not everyone has outlines. If you can share them or pass them around, etc., it'd be good. Okay. Number one, the question's really only relevant if you believe in God. If you don't believe in God, there's absolutely no reason at all that things should go well if you're a good person, things should not go well if you're a bad person, right? I mean, from the perspective, from a purely physical perspective, the bacteria actually doesn't know if you're a good guy or not. Gravity doesn't really care how much money you gave to charity, right? Cancerous cells don't really give a hoot how nice you are. So basically, within the laws of nature, there is absolutely no reason to expect that if you're a good person, things should go well. The reason humans do have that expectation, the reason we all feel that expectation that things should go well when I'm good and not go well when a person's bad, is because deep down we believe there's a God. Deep down we believe that someone is running the show. Since we do believe that, therefore it bothers us when things don't appear to be running according to the plan. Is this clear so far? Great. 1b, the explanation I'm giving is general. In other words, I will give explanations for suffering, etc., but they are general explanations, meaning they don't address specific people. That is to say, you ask me to explain a specific person, can't do that, because I don't have, and I don't think anyone has, all the information. His past, his potential, his future, the people he or she affects, and so on and so forth, is not really accessible to us. So therefore, I cannot give individual explanations. That's not a big problem, right? Because general explanations are what we usually give in many areas. Even in science, the explanations of events are general, even though you cannot necessarily make predictions or even know the position and velocity of particular particles. That's 1B. 1C, I'm not including in this self-inflicted suffering. The Rambam says this, I don't have to explain self-inflicted suffering. If the person's suffering because he's an idiot, right, let's say he smokes cigarettes. So this moron, right, complains that, oh, he's 60, he's got emphysema, has difficulty breathing. Hello, right, don't breathe in smoke through a tube of poisonous substance and you probably will have less breathing problems. Duh. Right? Or for example, someone takes a machete and chops off a finger, he cannot now say, oh my God, tzadik v'ralo, what happened? You know, like, hello, right? He did it to himself. So therefore, tremendous amount of suffering in the world is, as Maimonides points out, both as a philosopher and as a physician, much of it is self-inflicted. It is lifestyle choices, it is lack of self-control, stupidity, hormones, whatever it is. But basically, a tremendous amount of suffering is self-inflicted. And that, he says, he doesn't really have to explain. So if he doesn't, I don't. 1D. I'm sorry? Okay. This is still on. Power's on. And it's plugged in. Okay. I am recording it on iPod, so, okay. For those who are listening on MP3s, we apologize. Okay. 1D. These responses are intellectual responses, not emotional. Meaning, if God forbid, someone is sitting shiva, someone is suffering, etc., I am not going to go over to them and walk into the house and say, today's class will be on. Right? That's insensitive. That's not what they need. Someone who is suffering needs love. They need sympathy. They do not want intellectualization. They don't want rational answers. That's not what they need. So therefore, I would not suggest that this is a response to someone who's actually suffering at the present moment, because that's really not what they need to comfort them. The Gemara says that you get rewarded in a house of mourning just for being quiet. In fact, a lot of people, I would say, get rewarded for that most of the time. But nevertheless, right, in the house of mourning, the reward for being quiet is because all the person really needs is to know that someone else cares about them, loves them, and sympathizes with them, and that's a very important component. And 1E, when we talk about suffering, generally I find that the different understandings of the purpose of life that people have affect how strongly the question impacts them. In other words, someone who believes that the purpose of life is comfort will have a very rough time when there's any type of suffering whatsoever. Someone who understands that the purpose of life is something more than mere comfort will have less, because as we all know, certain things to get ahead in certain areas, whether it be in athletics, whether it be in academics, requires a certain level of struggle. It can't be done with comfort, right? If you want to be a great athlete, then you are dedicating yourself to a life of extreme discomfort. You have to continuously exert yourself, you have to continuously struggle, you have to continuously confront pain, and the same is true to be a top-level academic in any area, to be a Talmid Chacham, a scholar, whatever area you are dedicating yourself to, life is struggle. That's not a problem in the sense, because we understand that's part of what life is about, that's our purpose, right? It's not comfort. Comfort is the type of thing which is, animals pursue, not always successfully. But that is not necessarily what we're here for. So that is a little bit of an introduction. And now there are four basic groups of answers I'm going to give to this question. All of them pretty much gleaned from Rishonim, from Jewish medieval scholars. First of all, what I call reward and punishment. That is to say, looking into the past to understand what's happening now. In other words, on a simplest level, do we see reward and punishment? So, first of all, number A, 2A. Not everyone who looks righteous is actually righteous. A friend of mine was driving in his car on Herzl Boulevard in Yerushalayim, and next to his kids were sitting in the back with Rebbe cards. You have Rebbe cards here? Right? They have cards with pictures of rabbis on them, and instead of baseball cards, et cetera, you swap them, three rebbes for a Rosh Hashiva, that type of thing, anyway, they're sitting in the, no offense to anyone Hasidic here. Anyway, so they're sitting in the back of the car with the cards, and they see the car next to them is this beautiful, beautiful car, and it's being driven. And the guy, there's a guy in the back who's obviously got a chauffeur driving him, and the guy in the back is got a magnificent white beard and a, what you normally describe as a Litvish silk yarmulke type thing, and they're looking through their cars desperately to see who the tzaddik is in the car next to them. And they say, Abba, Abba, who is it? And he looks at the car, and it turns out it's the Greek Orthodox Patriarch of Jerusalem. Right, he was a Greek Orthodox priest who was head of the Greek Orthodox Church in Jerusalem. Not only is he not a tzaddik for that reason, but he's also not a tzaddik because he actually was arrested prior to that for drug smuggling in order to finance weapons for Palestinian terrorists. So I don't think he qualifies for the tzaddik cards, unless they have, some other echelon of cards, whatever, but I mean in general. So he pointed out to the kids, there's a great opportunity for a lesson. He said to them, from here you see, not everyone who is a tzaddik, who looks like a tzaddik, is a tzaddik. No one is perfect, right? Possible exception of Gateway staff, but for the rest of you lot, right? No one is actually perfect, and what that means is that every single person needs some level of perfection to get a little higher, to get a little better, to correct mistakes that they've made. Everyone makes mistakes. I remember I made a mistake in January of 74. It was February. Anyway, so people do make mistakes, and we all need to correct those. And the idea is that not all who appear good are necessarily good. That's number one. 2B, there are higher standards the more righteous you are. That is to say, as different from politics, generally, the higher up you go in politics, the more exempt you get from what happens to normal people. You know, so if you are really high up like a president, someone else will get thrown in jail, you get impeached. I'm not sure exactly what that means. It means the press says nasty things about you and you carry on like, you know, continue. Right? You know, you could become Prime Minister of Israel and you could do crimes which would put normal people in prison for life, many life sentences, and you can carry on. It's no big deal. Right? So the higher you up in politics, the more you get away with. When it's in the moral sphere, in the area of tzikus, righteousness and relationship with God, the higher you up, the less you should get away with, because the more is expected of you. I'll give you an example. Postage stamps. There were communities in Germany, Jewish communities in Germany, early 20th century, late 19th century, who used to have a custom that if they would send a letter with a private individual, and as opposed to through the post office, they'd go to the post office, buy a stamp and tear it up. What's the logic of that? Well, you see, the local post office was owned by a local family who'd make their income from the post office, you know, and it was like a franchise from the government. So they felt if too many people are not using the post office and sending letters through private individuals, what's going to happen to the people who run the post office? They're going to lose income. And the government may close down this particular post office because it's not doing that much business, and then it will cause harm to everyone. Now, this is not a halachic legal obligation. This is going beyond the letter of the law. But nevertheless, it's an amazing level of sensitivity of what they're doing. I hope everyone understands why they're doing it, right? But I mean, you're not obligated to do it, but it's a very high level of sensitivity. Right? Just for example, I mean, I remember used to go to a class, karate class in Har Nof and in Jerusalem. I was in mid-30s. Everyone else was 17 or 18. This was not ideal for my ego. There I was, middle-aged ninja mutant rabbi, and the rest of them, basically at the peak of their fitness and flexibility. So anyway, I'm standing next to a guy who has been studying his brown belt, that means one below black belt. And he's standing next to me, and we're practicing front kick, and Sensei, the teacher, right, comes over to this guy, almost black belt, and he is like, as the guy is doing the front kicks, he's throwing punches at him, so the guy's blocking him, he's screaming at him, he is criticizing him, it's unbelievable. I'm next in line, I'm thinking, what the heck, I'm paying for this, right, and I'm gonna be next. So he walks over to me, I was a plaid belt at the time, he walks over to me, and he looks at me, doing the front kick, and his reaction is, and he walks away. Now, is that because, my first thought was, I did the perfect front kick. Must be, because no. The real answer is, he is so happy that I was able to get my foot more or less horizontal with the floor, without causing massive injury to myself, right, without keeling over and having to sue him and stuff like that. He's very happy that I am intact and able to do this, that he has no criticisms, he's like happy. On the other hand, the guy who's almost a black belt, right, if he doesn't feel the guy's getting exactly the right snap, and he's not using the ki and the whole works, he doesn't have the heel forward and he's got the toes pulled back and he's not got the right hip movement, and he's also, he's telegraphing too much, if he's got tons of criticisms of this guy. Why? Because more is expected of him. So in spirituality also, the closer you are to the black belt, the more it's expected of you. Now a person might say, well, what's the use? Rav Elialopian once related when he was a kid, he actually was a kid once, as many Gedolim were. So anyway, Rav Elialopian, when he was a kid, his mother used to take out the china once every few months to dust it off and polish silver and stuff. Used to have it on the dining room table. So little Ellie is in the dining room, he's looking at it and he's bouncing a ball. And the ball hits some irregularity in the floor. I mean, it's Poland. I don't know what the floors were like. But it probably dirt. And it bounces, to his horror, onto the table and breaks a serving dish. And his mother walks into the room. She hears a smash. She walks into the room. She sees him. She sees the ball. She sees the serving dish. He gets a patch, a few of them, right? He gets sent to the room. He gets grounded, whatever they used to do in Poland. He gets grounded, right, etc. And he experienced a very unpleasant week or 2 weeks after that. Now, a few months later, his mother has the silver out and the china out again. This time, Ellie walks in, he sees it, and he says, not going to do anything. But to his horror, the window's open. A goose from the yard has jumped up onto the windowsill, on the windowsill, spreads out, flaps its wing, and the wing smashes another piece of china. You'd think his mother would get the message already. But okay, smashes another piece of china. And now his mother walks in, she sees him, he's pointing to the goose. She says, oh, okay. Right, so he's safe, all right. His mother takes the goose, gently places it out the window in the yard, closes the window, and cleans up and carries on. At that point, as a little kid, he thought, I wish I was a goose. I mean, I did the same thing as the goose, right? Here, I get patched, I get sent to my room, etc. The goose gets gently placed outside, and that's the end of it. Now, he thought this until the next Yontif. And this time he saw the goose again. But this time it was cooked, and it was on the silverware. It was on the crockery, right? And he realized at that point that sometimes it's better to get the occasional patch than to be a goose. And indeed, it is probably worth it in the end. So that is higher standards for the righteous, 2A, 2B. 2C, insufficient reproof of the generation. It is our belief it is not sufficient just to not hurt anyone. I mean, I know that in the Western world, right, they consider you absolutely a perfect person if you've never hurt anyone. I've never hurt anyone. You haven't done a darn thing for anyone else. Totally selfish, right? Egotistical maniac, right? But you haven't hurt anyone, right? So that's considered to be good. But that's not enough. I mean, if you go into a doctor's office and it says on the wall, big advertisement, no one killed this month, right? It wouldn't inspire me with confidence, you know? I'd want to see that not only did he not kill anyone, but he also actually healed one or two people. You know what I mean? I'd like to see that. So it's not enough. So we believe that it's not enough to be righteous in and of yourself. You're also supposed to get other people, help, encourage, rebuke, reprove, so on and so forth, to get other people also to be good people. And if a person is in a position that they can influence other people and they don't, they are held responsible for the other people. If I can influence my family and I don't, I'm responsible for them. If I can influence my neighborhood and I don't, I'm responsible for the neighborhood. If I'm able to influence the city and I don't, I'm responsible for the whole city. If I'm able to influence the entire country or world, I'm responsible for that. Everyone has some sphere, and of course, the higher up a person is, the greater the degree of responsibility for others. 2C. 2D. D and E are flip sides of each other. That is to say, we believe that the life of a human being, or the life of the soul, is way beyond the body. That means it started before, and it continues after. And so, in fact, it is possible that a person may be punished here, in this world, in order that their soul will achieve a higher level of perfection in the world to come. It is also possible that a person might get rewarded here in this world because they don't deserve the reward in the world to come. How does that work? Exactly. A person is generally paid in a currency which is valuable to them. If someone comes to my house, does some work, moves some furniture or gets rid of garbage in the backyard, right, so I might give him a tip. Now, if it's before Pesach, might want to get rid of some beer. So I have like a six-pack of beer. Here's some Corona, whatever. It's decent, right? So I say, here's a six-pack of Corona. Or I say, I have got actually an impetuous little Californian wine harvested just before dawn by some unwashed Sicilian immigrants, right, from the north side of the vineyard. And it's really excellent bouquet, and I think you'll really appreciate this. Now, I can tell certain people look at that and say, give me the beer. Out of your mind, right? And certain people will say, oh, yes, I've been wanting to try that particular vintage, and thank you very much. Now, generally, the person who's cleaning out the junk in my backyard, no offense, right, is probably going to appreciate the beer more than the wine, right? And so you get paid in the currency that you value. So therefore, let's say you have a person who's corrupt, who's totally materialistic. So that person may have done some good things in their life. A lot of people do. Just sometimes by sheer accident, we stumble across a mitzvah. It's not our fault. Right? So sometimes a person may have done a good thing, but since he doesn't value spirituality, what does he value? His Hummer. Right? What he values is something else. So guess what? He may get rewarded by a cheeseburger. He may get rewarded by having greater material comfort, etc., which of course is not ultimately going to help him that much, right? It means that he won't get the ultimate spiritual reward of closeness to God. A person who values closeness to God, a person who values the spiritual, may actually get a spiritual reward and may be punished here. Now, it doesn't automatically work that way. Because it's possible that a person who is, nevertheless, who values the material for what it can do in terms of the spiritual, may also be given the material to help him. Example, Judah the prince, Yehuda Hanasi, who wrote the Mishnah, was also fabulously wealthy. So it's not an automatic condemnation to poverty if the person is righteous, right? I'm just saying that one of the possibilities is that the person may be rewarded here if that's all they appreciate, so that God avoids paying them in the world to come, or he may punish a person here so they avoid being punished in the world to come. Finally, 2F, there is a view amongst the Kabbalists of what we call reincarnation, or Gilgul. Gilgul Neshamas means reincarnation, that your soul was here before. And therefore, sometimes things happen to a person, it is believed by the Kabbalists, sometimes things happen to a person because of the life they had before. I'll give you one example of that, maybe two. All right, example, Baal Shem Tov, I think it was Baal Shem Tov, famous founder of the Hasidic movement, as you know, right? One day, before davening, before morning prayers, he calls over the Mohel, circumciser, and he says, listen, I need you, and I need you to bring with 8 Hasidim. We need a minion. We're going to do a bris, circumcision. And so, they get the minion together, Baal Shem Tov, the Mohel, 8 others, they get into the stretch carriage, right, and they start driving off, right, into the countryside, near Medjibozj, right, or whatever. Anyway, so they come, it's a horrific weather, it is snowing, there's been freezing rain, it's terrible, terrible weather, right, the carriage is sliding all over the place, whatever. Anyway, they finally come to this small house, and they stop at the house, and they come, schlep to the front door, the snow, they knock on the door, and the guy answers the door, and he says, with shock, he says, wow! And the Baal Shem Tov says, Mazel Tov, we're here to do the bris. Everyone's like, what the heck? Right? And so they come in, it turns out that this guy's wife gave birth 8 days earlier. The weather was horrific, their wagon was broken, the horse was half dead, the roads were full of snow, right? It was one of these classic Hasidic stories. And they couldn't get anywhere, they didn't know how to give, what are we going to do? Yeah, they couldn't get onto the internet and that, you know, do-it-yourself Bris Miller kits, that type of stuff, right? You can't do, you can get it probably from Amazon, right? But they didn't do that, right? So what are they going to do? So it turns out that the Baal Shem Tov had this inspiration, and anyway, so they come in, they do the bris, the father calls the kid Yosef. Yosef. So Yosef, his mother immediately takes him after the bris and nurses him to calm him down. There's a horrific scream from the next room, and the mother comes back. Oh, they run into the room and they see the baby has died. And what was a celebration of a bris milah becomes a mourning and sadness. They comfort the parents as much as possible and bury the child and they leave. So horrific story. So anyway, on the way back in the carriage, the Hasidim asked the Baal Shem Tov, could you explain what was going on here? So the Baal Shem Tov said, yeah, today was the Yahrzeit anniversary of the death of Rabbi Yosef Karo, author of the Code of Jewish Law. Rabbi Yosef Karo was an unbelievable great scholar, tremendous Kabbalist, tzaddik. He said, but he lacked one thing. When he was born, there was some type of epidemic where he lived, and he was not able to have bris milah until he was about 6 weeks old. So all his soul needed was one thing. What did his soul need? Bris on the 8th day. He says, you notice that the father called the kid Yosef. And we believe, Kabbalists say, that there's a little bit of prophecy, a little bit of divine inspiration when the parent gives the child a name at the bris. And he says, that child's neshama, the soul, was the soul of Yosef Karo, Rabbi Yosef Karo, the base Yosef. And once the soul had bris milah on the 8th day, it left the world. So then the Chazan said, but what about the mother, the father? He says, I don't know the whole story. He says, but one part of the story I can tell you, and that's a little bit of an explanation. And indeed, the Zohar understands that much of what happens to us in this world, positive and the opposite, can often happen because our soul needs a particular, what we call tikkun, particular thing to happen to it, a perfection. Something needs to happen, something needs to occur to it, and that, of course, is why sometimes suffer. So that is our first category, meaning, why is something happening? Because of something in the past, reward and punishment. The next category is what we do is we look to the future to justify what's happening now. That's number 3, consequences. First of all, 3A, to show others how to bear suffering. I know a person in Yerushalayim, she and her husband were married for about 8 years. They did not have children. And very rough time, she had numerous miscarriages and stillbirths, which hard for us to relate to, impossible for us to relate to, but very, very overwhelming for her, very depressing, very, very difficult situation. Now, after 8 years, thank God they had children. Started having children, and now I think they have like 4 or 5 children, and wonderful. And interesting, during the time she was suffering through the infertility, she started going to courses in counseling, psychology, etc. Now, afterwards, she got a degree in counseling. And she is an amazing counselor, and she helps women who have gone through these type of issues, infertility, stillbirths, miscarriages, etc. And if you can, as I guess you can imagine, no one would be better suited to help people than her, correct? Right? She is a woman, first of all, right? So she can actually know what they're going through. She went through it herself, so she can really and totally relate to it, right? And she has had the experience of counseling, she had courses in counseling. So she's amazing. However, it's interesting, she looks back and she says, all that I went through, I'm now using in an amazing way. Had anyone came to her and told her during the time she was suffering, listen, don't worry, you can have a career in counseling. The miscarriage was so bad, right? What would her reaction have been? She said, I would have broken his nose. Right? It would have like popped him right there. I mean, she said, like, why? Because that's totally, aside from being totally insensitive, no one can really know that. But she herself looks back on that history, her own history, and says, I'm a different and better person now. I remember I was in South Africa teaching together with, I was doing a tour with a good friend of mine, David Orlovsky. So we're touring around South Africa together. And we met this guy in a place called Mount Amanzi, which is a game resort. We were doing a Shabbaton at a game reserve, type of interesting. Anyway, so we met this guy. The guy was very depressed. And turns out that he was living in Joburg, Johannesburg. He had a fantastic career. He was brilliant. He was handsome. He was athletic. And he was totally unsuccessful in getting past the first date with any woman who would have a shit up with, who would go out with. I was just like, totally unsuccessful. But everything else was fantastic. And then, to top this off, his mother got sick, and he had to move out of Johannesburg to a place in the south of the country, Durban, right, which was not much of a Jewish social scene at all, and take care of his mother. He ended up taking care of his mother for about a year and a half. She passed away. And during that time, his social life was totally zero, right? But it's interesting, when he came back to Johannesburg, so that's when we met him. Now, we met him again a couple of years later. He'd come back to Johannesburg, and he was now engaged. And he said, you know what, amazing. The reason, he says, that no one really wanted to continue going out with me, he says, because I had this great career. I was like top of the world. I was like handsome, you know, brilliant, etc. Right? And he says, but you know what? The only thing I ever spoke about was myself. I was so successful. I was so into myself. That's all I could think about, as they said in the recent movie, swimming in Lake Me. Right? That's what he was doing. He was swimming and he was drowning in Lake Me. Right? And so he says the experience of going to Durban, right, and caring for another person, even though it was suffering at the time and she was suffering, but he says it changed him and made him someone who is more capable of forming a relationship with someone else. They're not so, the only thing they think about is not themselves. Very, very important. 3B, and this is similar, development of noble characteristics. And we know it's true in every area of life. Very often you develop best when you have stretched yourself, when you have struggled, when you have overcome overwhelming odds. You know, anyone who knows violin or guitar, right, if the string is not stretched, it doesn't produce very good music, right? When the string is stretched, it produces good music. The same is true of the human being. The reason that is so is because it is essential. The world was created for free will. If you can imagine for the moment that no effort was required to improve, you didn't have to struggle against anything, then it would be totally meaningless. A world without free will, we'll talk about that a little further in answer number 5, but is a meaningless world, so therefore there is going to be struggle. 3C, to defocus on peripherals and focus on essentials, perspective. You know, very often, right, God will make someone suffer in order to focus them on things which are important in life, things which are not important in life. Sometimes it's only when a person is actually in pain or sometimes suffering or deprived of something, they'll realize that what are some of the important things in life, what are the peripherals. As a person said, right? I forgot who it was, but it was someone who was trapped in the World Trade Center. He phoned home. He conveyed messages of love and other things to his family. He said, and someone pointed out, his wife pointed out, the last thing he thought about was not stocks. And the last thing you think about is not your car. The last thing he thinks about is things which are much more important. Very often, right, when we're in a state in which we lack something, that's when we begin to appreciate what we actually have. And also, number 3D, is it really bad? See, saying that something is good or bad is a little bit of a subjective judgment. It's not always so obvious. You may have heard of Douglas Bader. Anyone heard of Douglas Bader? No one. Okay. You have. Excellent. Douglas Bader was British. Correct. He was a British fighter pilot. Very famous British fighter pilot. Excellent. From Passaic, obviously. Right, anyway, better class of education, elementaries. So Douglas Bader with this great fighter pilot. Now, what's interesting about Douglas Bader, he won every award just about that England gave. He was almost single-handedly responsible. I mean, not single-handedly, but he did a tremendous amount in the Battle of Britain, where the British Air Force shot down Luftwaffe bombers and fighters that was a prelude to the invasion of England by the Nazis. He did an unbelievable... And more than just being a great fighter pilot, he also trained many other pilots to fly and inspired them. But what's interesting to note is, before the Second World War, Douglas Bader was in an airplane accident and he lost both legs. He was a double amputee and he had artificial legs. And at the time, the artificial legs, the prosthetics, were not very advanced as they are today. Right, and even today, obviously, it's a great tragedy, but then it was much worse. And so I met a pilot, Canadian, who'd volunteered for the British, for the RAF, Royal Air Force. He'd come over, and the guy, Douglas Bader, gets out of a jeep and stumps over to them and starts teaching them, and they thought it was some type of bizarre joke. What are they sending us? This guy who's double amputee is going to teach us how to fly? But he got into the plane with some assistance. He did maneuvers that no one could, they didn't understand that you could even do that, right? He was able to do them partially because he didn't have a problem of the blood pressure going down in the top half of the body and blacking out at the G's because he didn't really, which is strangely enough, but that was an advantage to him in the fighter planes. And what happened was he inspired people. He actually was shot down in a bombing mission over Germany during the Second World War, and he escaped twice from a prisoner of war camp in Germany. Eventually, even the Germans had such respect for him that there was a prisoner of war exchange, I believe, during the Second World War via Switzerland, and he eventually got out. What's amazing here is that probably a lot of the success of Douglas Bader, A, in flying, and B, in training and inspiring other people to fly and basically helping to save England from the Nazi invasion, much of that was directly a result of the fact that he had an accident and he lost both his legs. Not possible to see these type of things ahead of time. It's possible to see these things sometimes when you look back, right? As it says, or Isaiah Sacharei, looking back. I'll give you another example, right? We have the benefit of having the ability to go to Israel as a state of Israel, right? The state of Israel was a result of a political Zionist movement, which, amongst other things, but which started as a result of some very interesting things. Let's go back a couple of hundred years. There was a fellow by the name of Charles Dreyfus, who was a captain in the French army, and France had, as usual, lost another war, and there were a lot of recriminations, and their conclusion was there was a spy. It so happened this time, they were right, there was a spy. He was a man by the name of Baron Esterhazy. But Baron Esterhazy figured, look, the French are not exactly lovers of Jews. He said, there's a Jew working on the staff called Captain Dreyfus. If I accuse him, the heat's off me. So he forged some letters, and he accused Dreyfus of being a spy, and of course the French court said, well, of course he's a Jew, duh. Right? So basically, he was arrested, and he was tried and held guilty as a spy, and sent to Devil's Island, which was this horrific little prison colony that the French had, and that was the end of the Dreyfus affair. But during the Dreyfus affair, oh, and by the way, before the Dreyfus affair, there were two other incidents. Number one, France had tried to dig a canal across the South Central American isthmus known as the Panama Canal. They failed, right? They failed because their people came down with all types of tropical diseases. Guess who the French blamed? They did not blame the mosquito or the tsetse fly. The French blamed the Jews. Why? How's it the Jews' fault? Because the Jews in France were bankers who sold bonds and stocks and options in order to finance the Panama Canal project. So therefore, when it failed, instead of blaming disease, they blamed the Jews. Exactly. Very convenient. And right around that time, the Vatican, which had a bank in France, and due to mismanagement and corruption, the bank started to fail. Another bank bought the bank, hostile takeover. A lot of people lost money, but the bank survived. Guess who the people that bought the Vatican Bank were? The Rothschilds. Jewish family. So there was a lot of anti-Semitism in France, aside from their regular good old Catholic French European anti-Semitism, the Minhag. Right? And so, right after that, you have the Dreyfus trial. There were mobs running through the streets of Paris yelling, death to the Jews. And there's a reporter, totally assimilated, right, from originally born in Budapest, bar mitzvahed at the Dohany Street Synagogue, grew up in Vienna. His name was Theodor Herzl, right? Theodor Herzl is covering this for some Viennese newspaper. He sees these people yelling death to the Jews. He starts for the first time in his life thinking about Judaism and the Jews and stuff like that. And he comes up with this idea of maybe we should have a country, right? Which is not a new idea, right? That was God's idea, right? So, but we had a country nevertheless, right? He wasn't sued for that, right? And he started to form this political Zionist movement and so on, etc. And as a result of that, many years later, we had 1948, 60 years ago, the State of Israel, which is pretty amazing. But of course, if you look at it from Dreyfus's point of view, rotting on Devil's Island, right, and you tell him it's all going to be fine, you know, no problem, right, he doesn't really see it that way because he's involved. We have the benefit of looking in hindsight. We can look back over the events and we can say, oh, like the end of a mystery novel, where it finally comes to the point where, you know, they assemble, you know, where the detective assembles everyone in the drawing room of the medieval castle and points to the butler and says, he did it. Right? And in which case you say, oh, of course, I never would have suspected the butler, even though he has a longer, you know, history of criminal offences and he walks around with a machete. But nevertheless, right, that's the, when the revelation comes that it was a butler, everything fits together. Same is true of the idea of, is it really bad and is it really good? Sometimes money is not really good. I have actually read of a study done, I think it was Johns Hopkins University did the study, of people who've won large amounts of money in the lottery. You may have heard of Johns Hopkins, a branch of Neri Stroll in Baltimore. Anyway, so Johns Hopkins University, they did this study, and it was interesting. They found that a lot of people who won large amounts of money in the lottery ended up depressed, suicidal, addicted to drugs and alcohol, and in huge debt. Right? Not an uncommon situation. People get this money and they start, there was a guy in England very recently, he ran £20 million. He had this huge wedding which cost millions. He gave money away to this person, that person, he bought this house. He is now bankrupt. He's got people suing him, right? His wife wants a divorce it's total collapse. So sometimes it can be a curse, right? It'll be a challenge. I wouldn't mind the challenge, right? But, right, sometimes this type of thing could be for a lot of people, what's good and what's bad is not always immediately obvious. That is number three. Number four, incomplete information. I know it sounds like a cop-out, but it is legitimate. That is to say that sometimes we say a person is good, and something bad is happening, or bad, something good happening, we don't necessarily have all the information. We might be, the Lubavitcher Rebbe uses this example, we might be like someone, you know, you can imagine, let's say some people from a society where there is no modern medicine, some Stone Age tribe somewhere, Amazon Basin or whatever in New Guinea, and some guy has an accident, and he's taken to this modern hospital. Right, and the modern hospital, his friend has a problem with his leg, and the surgeon puts him in the operating theatre, and now this guy sees them sticking needles in his friend. And he's banging on the glass, he says, what are you doing? Right, and they're sticking needles in, and they take blood out of him. He says, oh my God, why are they taking blood out? And then they stick this thing over his face, and he stops breathing, apparently. Right, and then they start, then the surgeon takes out this, like, you know, whatever, this chainsaw, whatever they use. Anyway, and then horrific sting. Now, he cannot understand it. Let's say, A, he doesn't have an understanding of modern medicine, and it co-happens he's the most stupid person in the village anyway, so even if he didn't have modern medicine, he wouldn't have understood it. And it's an emergency operation. Can it be possible to explain to him what's happening? I think it'd be very rough. So if you compare the knowledge gap between God and us, it's probably much more significant than between the top surgeon at Massachusetts General and the most stupid guy in the village in New Guinea, right? The gap is actually even further, right? So that's number one. 4B, and that's actually what God answered Job. We don't even understand why everything happens in the physical world. Very often, much of science is not why, but describing what is happening. Right? And the whys of things are not always something which we can ever get to. And sometimes we have incomplete information. The Midrash, number 4C, gives, don't ask me to repeat this, but I hope I get it wrong, right the first time. Apparently Moses asked God this question, why do the righteous suffer? So Hashem says, let me show you the following scene. So Hashem shows him a video. In the video, he sees, what happens is this general, apparently a senior soldier, is riding on a horse. He stops with his horse to get water from some watering hole. The horse drinks the water. As he gets back on his horse, his wallet drops. He drops his wallet. And he rides off not realizing that he's dropped his wallet. In the meantime, this teenager walks by, sits in the middle of nowhere. He sees a wallet on the ground. There's no ID. Remember, this is many years ago. There's no ID. He picks it up. He says, cool. And he walks off with the wallet. In the meantime, another guy, right, walks by, elderly man who's a drunk, right, alternative lifestyle, right, he's totally drunk, derelict, right, and he sees the watering hole, he washes a little bit, not too much, right, because he wants to, whatever. Anyway, so, and he lies down, he goes to sleep. Now, this soldier, the general, he gets to the next place he's staying, the inn, and he reaches for his wallet and he realizes, oh my gosh, my wallet's not here. Horrible sinking feeling. Right, he figures out the only time he could have lost it is at the watering hole. He gallops back to the watering hole. He sees this old drunk guy lying by the watering hole and he figures, this guy's taken the wallet. So he wakes him up and he says, where's my wallet? The guy says, I don't know what you're talking about. He says, my wallet, I want the money. And the guy says, I don't know what you're talking about. He takes out a knife. He says, you tell me where the wallet is or I'll kill you right now. So the guy says, I don't know where it is. He kills him. Searches him, doesn't find the wallet. Says, okay, no big deal. And he rides off. God says to Moses, you see, perfect justice. So Moshe says, I think I'm missing something here. So Hashem says, I'll show you another video. So the next video he shows him is the following. There's a young soldier who is camped out somewhere and he hears some screams. He looks out, he gets up, he looks over these bushes and he sees there's a kid and his father who have been attacked by a thief. And the thief is beating the kid's father, slaps the kid a few times, takes the money. Now the soldier is probably a New Yorker, he doesn't want to get involved, so he waits till the end of it, then he sees that the father is lying unconscious on the ground, the kid's crying his head off, and the thief is about to escape with a wad of money. So now the soldier jumps out with his sword and he says, I'll take that, thank you. Right, this guy says, gives him the money, right, the soldier takes the money and rides off into the distance, and the thief is left there without money, he runs off, and the kid's lying there, right, his father's unconscious, he's crying, no money. So God tells Moses, you see, perfect justice, right? So Moshe Rabbeinu says, I don't get it. So now, listen carefully, Hashem says to Moses, listen carefully. The second story happened first. And the kid in the second story is the teenager who finds the money in the first story, right? He says, the thief in the second story, who stole the money, right, and who beat up the kid's father, he's the drunk who gets beaten up, who gets killed by the soldier in the first video. And he says, and the young soldier who intervened and took the money, but didn't kill the guy who was attacking, he is the general who loses the wallet, who kills the drunk, who was the thief in the second story, in the first story. Did everyone follow that? Do not make me repeat this. Right? But that's basically. So very often, what do we see? We might see things out of sequence. We may not know who is who in the various characters in the video of life that we see. And consequently, we don't have the information. I'll give you one example. There's a teacher of mine, found this out recently. He was a refugee from Germany, before the Second World War. He was sent to England. Now in England, the English arrested a lot of Jews who escaped Europe because they were enemy aliens, Right? So enemy aliens, if you're a German citizen, granted you are Jewish, too bad, enemy alien. And many of them were sent to Australia. And so they put them on a ship and sent a number of them to Australia. So he was a kid, he was on this ship, sent to Australia from England during the Second World War. Now, the ships, which were not important ships, a lot of the England was running out of sailors, and so they released a lot of criminals from prison early and used them to as sailors on the merchant marine fleet. And so here you are, he escaped from Germany, he's in England, he gets arrested, he's on the ship, he's bound for a place he's never heard of, right? He's on the ship, there are submarines all over the place who are just more than happy to sink British ships, and the ship is populated or run by basically British criminals, which might be a tautology, but okay. Right, British criminals. And what happens is, as soon as they get a little further away from land, the sailors start beating up the Jews and searching them for money and things like that. Anything of value which the sailors found, they kept. Anything else they found which the Jews possessed, which the sailors didn't believe had any value, they chucked overboard. So if you had tefillin, nothing, they threw it overboard. Books, threw overboard. Silver candlesticks, sailors kept. Money, the sailors kept. So basically, these Jews, very depressed, they now get beaten up, and everything that's of value to them is taken. So he gets to Australia, and they get sent to an internment camp, which actually said conditions improved, the locals were very friendly, they got jobs, they eventually got out of the camp, and he eventually grew up in Melbourne, Australia, became a teacher of mine in high school, which was a low point of his life. But anyway, nevertheless, about 50 years or so after these events, a German U-boat captain, but he released memoirs. And in his memoirs, his autobiography, he writes how he was a captain of a submarine, and he sees a British ship on the way south from England. And his first thought was to torpedo the ship, but then he saw that there was wire up in certain areas of the ship. And he thought to himself, it could be, if there's wire around the ship, it could be they're transporting German prisoners of war. There might be German soldiers on this ship, I'm not going to shoot. He says, now what he sees is they throw things off the ship. He sees things being thrown off the ship. So he shadows the ship for a while, he surfaces behind, and he picks up, he gets the sailors to pick up a couple of things. Now, it so happens the things that they picked up that were thrown off the ship were some German books. And so he immediately came to the conclusion that obviously on this ship called the Danira, there must be German soldiers who are prisoners of war. So he says, there's no way I'm going to torpedo this ship. So he radios for instructions, and he escorts it to make sure that no one else torpedoes the ship. And the ship made it safely to Australia. So now, when my teacher read about this, he got a little bit of a revelation here. He said, you know what? When our stuff was thrown overboard, that saved our lives. Because the fact that it was thrown overboard meant that this captain would pick it up, see a German book, and make the incorrect conclusion that there were German prisoners on the ship. Had he known it was Jews on the ship being sent to Australia, he would have torpedoed it in a second. So, again, we don't always know the complete story, sometimes not until 50 years later. Incomplete information. And now we come to the final answer. The final answer, number 5, is what I call the, what is sometimes called the free will defense. The free will defense of suffering is the following. First of all, we believe, and we'll talk about this at greater length at a later stage, that the purpose of creation is ultimately for God to give to us. God wants to give to us. But you see, giving has complications. You know, if sometimes it's embarrassing, if someone showers you with presents continuously, right, or if someone just like walks over to you and starts giving you money, it's a little embarrassing, right? Now, if you need it and they give it to you, it's even more embarrassing, right? And if you have to beg for it, it's even more embarrassing, right? Built into us is the desire to be independent. Why? Because we are similar to, created similar to God, who doesn't need anyone or anything. So, but in order to be independent means that every level of spirituality, every level of greatness, every level of perfection we get, we should get it from the fact that we have earned it, as opposed to being given it. Okay? So that means the ultimate good available to us has got to be through our efforts, through free will. Now, think of it like this. Free will requires a very, very important factor. What free will requires is that that it not be a world where there's an automatic reaction to everything I do. I don't know if anyone has studied psychology, but in psychology labs, they use rats running around in a Skinner maze. You know what a Skinner maze is? B.F. Skinner, famous behavioralist psychologist. So B.F. Skinner used to have these, you know, have these rats in a maze. The rat, Nebuch, presses a lever, right, and it gets, if it presses one lever, it gets food pellets. If it presses another lever, it gets bipolar electroconvulsive therapy, right, etc. So the rats will obviously learn to press the appropriate lever. If you're wondering what those levers are in the dorms, that's why. Anyway, so you get these levers and it's conditioned responses, right? So now, you shouldn't really call them rats, it's not politically correct. We actually are supposed to call them non-human animal research participants. So the little non-human animal research, sorry, well, not dirty rats, but the hygienically challenged non-human animal research participants, right, run around the mazes and press the levers. Now, imagine if life was like a Skinner maze, meaning I walk into a store, I look around, I see it's only 10 shoplifting days till Hanukkah, right? And I reach for something that I would like, and I get an electric shock. So obviously, right, I will not steal that. Not because I think it's wrong to steal, not because I'm honest, but because I don't like electric shocks. Even if they are only 120 volts, right? Australia's 220 volts. Man's country. Anyway, so now, even if it's only 100, you don't want electric shock. So now, of course, you walk out and you see someone who says, hey, can you spare $1.25 for a cup of latte? Right? And I give him the money, right? Some tzedakah. When I do that, as soon as I give him charity, a camera crew comes out from an alley and says, congratulations! You are the first person today to give charity in New York City! You're going to be live on the Dave Letterman Show tonight! And you get a free trip to etc., etc. Right? And you say, oh, cool. Now, obviously, if that type of stuff happens, I'll be giving charity a lot and I will not be stealing much. Unless I'm crazy. Okay? So the way it works is, I might do good things and things are not going to work out. I might make, or for instance, I might be honest in the card game and still lose. I may cheat and win. I might be honest in business and not do well as the guy who cheats and connives his way and scratches his way to the top. Right? Because if it was any other way, we wouldn't really have a free will environment. We'd just be doing things as conditioned responses. Instead of being sentient beings, we'd be a bunch of rats. Lab rats. Right? And not the type that can take over the world, but just pathetic, normal lab rats, right? We would be, that would be terrible. So, you see, we really want responsibility, right? And we want independent thought, but the only way to really have that responsibility and that independence is if we are in a situation where the consequences are going to be suffered. So, for example, a good parent, I mean, obviously, I'm sure all of you are able to ride two-wheeler bikes, right? Probably no one here rides a tricycle, right? So two-wheelers, I'm always amused by these old bikers. You ever seen them on the tricycle bikes? You know, the motorbikes with three wheels? It's so pathetic, right? It was so pathetic. I mean, anyway. But how did you learn to ride a two-wheeler? Well, generally, the way it works is like this. Your father, mother, or older sibling, whoever draws the short straw, right, is supposed to go outside with you, hold on to the seat or your shirt or part of your anatomy, right, and run alongside you as you're on the bike wobbling and instruct you things like, yeah, turn into the fall, which is counterintuitive, so you don't do that and you fall over. And anyway, there's this person running behind you holding the seat. Eventually, they let go and you can ride yourself. Now, this takes some practice. Some kids hitch onto it immediately. Some kids it takes 4 or 5 years, whatever. But let's say I'm a really compassionate parent. This is purely imaginary. But let's say I would be a very compassionate parent, and I say I don't want ever to have my child scrape his knee. So therefore, I don't ever let go of the seat. So there he is. He's 16. He's on his bike on the way to yeshiva. Right? And running behind the bike holding the seat is me. Right? Holding onto the seat. I mean, so would you say, oh, look at him, what a wonderful parent. Or would you say that's child abuse? Right? I would say it's child abuse. Right? I mean, you've got to, if you want your child to become an independent, human being, a thinking, mature adult, that you've got to let go of the bike seat at a certain point, even if it means they're going to scrape their knee. That's the way the cookie crumbles. That's the way the cookie crumbles, as we say in Hebrew. Right? So the idea here is that God lets go of the seat, because he wants us to be God-like, independent, mature, sentient thinkers who make decisions of our own free will and choose good because it's good, choose to avoid evil because it's evil, choose truth because it's true, and negate falsehood because it is false, not because we're pressing the lever that gives us bipolar electroconvulsive therapy. So that is the what we call the free will defense of why good things happen to bad people, bad things happen to good people. That is to say that very often, right, things will not look, you won't see the cause and effect immediately, because if you did see cause and effect immediately, you wouldn't really be free. Those are some of the answers to the question of why good things happen to bad people, bad things happen to good people. The rest is commentary. Go and learn. Thank you very much for listening.